and this is the Convict Australia podcast. Thank you for tuning in. It was the evening of the 13th of January, 1834, when two convicts named Shires and Leslie burst into the ship's cabin and levelled their pistols at Captain Tor and Mr. Hoy the shipwright. Shires, who had his pistol pointing in the face of Hoy, said, quote, "We've got the vessel now, and if you don't give yourself up, I will blow your brains out," end quote. Captain Tor instantly leapt into action, trying to wrestle the pistol out of the hands of Leslie, and Hoy tried to do the same, but was far too sick to respond quickly enough and gave Shires little resistance. After much tussling, the captain managed to rip the pistol from Leslie's grip and threw him up against the cabin ladder. He soon felt the cold barrel of a loaded musket beaten into his skull, right into his left eye, by a convict named Benjamin Russen. Captain Tor was momentarily blinded, and Leslie took this chance to release himself from the captain's grip, grabbed a small axe and dealt the captain an almighty blow to the head, which left a deep cut. Despite blood pouring down the captain's head, Shires, who had now left his watch over Hoy, came to assist his mates and rained several blows down on the captain. Still, the captain continued to fight, and Nichols, another convict, came to the captain's aid. The two of them fought the pirates and even managed to push them backwards onto the deck. As the pirates retreated to their other convict mates, the captain hastily grabbed ammunition from the lockers in the cabin and began loading his musket. Mr. Hoy did his best to load his pistol but had no ramrod and was so ill that he was of little use. Meanwhile, pirate convicts Russen, Lyons and Barker took off the skylight above the cabin and fired shots down upon the men, narrowly missing them. The captain pointed his musket at the hatchway, ready for a second volley, but the pirates called down to him, quote, "We have got everybody secured. It is of no use you and Mr. Hoy contending against us," end quote. The convicts assured the captain that if he and the shipwright gave themselves up, they would not be killed, and warned them against doing anything to sabotage the convicts' getaway, such as breaking quadrants, compasses, or anything else they might need for their escape. Realizing he was outnumbered, the captain reluctantly gave himself up, and the convicts quickly took their firearms away from them and secured their hands behind their backs. The 10 armed pirates had now secured the ship Frederick. The Frederick was a new brig that hadn't been completed. Work began on the Frederick in a penal settlement on Sarah Island in Macquarie Harbour in Tasmania. The penal settlement had all but been abandoned, with the majority of convicts and officers being sent to Port Arthur. Only a skeletal crew were left behind to finish the Frederick, and when it was complete, they were to sail to Port Arthur. Only 12 convicts were kept behind, employed as shipwrights, and were later to act as crew when the vessel was set to sail. A great deal of trust was placed in the convicts, which was surprising considering that Sarah Island was a secondary punishment site which was largely made up of convicts who had tried to escape in the past. At the height of its occupation, it had 386 prisoners, mostly men. It was an incredibly isolated outpost, surrounded by uncharted, dense wilderness and a river that met the sea in a narrow, dangerous channel that had been nicknamed by convicts as Hell's Gates. Sarah Island had a fierce reputation as the most brutal secondary punishment site, with many going mad or choosing death rather than serve out another day there. The pirates rounded up all their victims and put them into the jolly boat. Along with Captain Tor and the shipwright, Mr. Hoy, there were four soldiers, a free man named James Tate, and two convicts, Nichols and McFarlane, who would not join in on the mutiny. The pirates ordered them to row to Wellington Head, the southern point of Macquarie Harbour, and were followed closely by four armed convicts in a whale boat. When they arrived, the convicts ordered them out of the boat, and the pirates tied the jolly boat to their whale boat before pushing off and rowing away. They called out that they would return the next morning with some provisions for them. True to their word, they did return, leaving the men with some supplies, and then returned to the Frederick, and shortly after daybreak, they had passed Hell's Gates and were clear out to sea. James Porter, one of the convicts, recalled, quote, "I cannot express my feelings at that moment. My heart expanded within me, and I believe it was the happiest moment of my life," end quote. Weeks of planning had gone into capturing the Frederick, and then they had to wait for the right time to strike. Barker, a convict working as a gunsmith in the settlement, had been secretly making them arms and hiding them away. When all the arms were ready, they waited until an opportunity presented itself. They took their chance when two of the four soldiers decided to go fishing away from the vessel and without the permission of the captain. The remaining two soldiers were on deck unarmed. They had taken the ship quickly using the element of surprise. Only 4 out of the 10 pirates had experience sailing, and they were working with a ship that wasn't entirely ready for an open sea voyage. In fact, the ship was designed to hug coastlines and certainly wasn't built to battle the heavy seas of the Southern and Pacific Oceans. The Frederick required a big, experienced crew to man its sails. It had more sails than most ships, and most of the sails were very worn. The main topsail was meant for a much smaller ship, and they had no square mainsail. The only new sail on board was the foresail. The ship was, however, well provisioned with food and tools. On board were 3 or 4 casks of Irish beef, a goat and a kid, dozens of ducks and fowls, 3 pigs, 2 geese, and bags of flour, and quantities of biscuits, sugar, tea, and even some spirits, not to mention a tomcat for good luck. They also had the advantage of a huge head start. Captain Tor and his party would not be able to reach a settlement and send word of the seizure of the Frederick for weeks. The Frederick was also a fast-sailing vessel, so it was highly unlikely that anyone would be able to catch up with them. It was assumed that the pirates would sail to New Zealand, but they had much grander plans than that. They were going to make the epic journey to Chile. It was apparently Barker who suggested Chile. Chile was somewhere the authorities wouldn't suspect, and it had recently gained its independence from Spain. The convicts would also be following the prevailing winds, making it easier to get there. They could sail south, avoiding one of the busiest shipping lanes. Plus, James Porter had a wife and child in Chile, whom he hadn't seen in about 15 years. They started heading south-southwest, but within an hour or two of leaving Hell's Gates, they noticed a small leak. This wasn't unusual for a brand new ship. The planking needed time to settle, something this ship never got the chance to do. They hastily found the 2 pumps on board and put them to work, only to discover that one of the pumps wasn't functioning. The pumps hadn't been tested before the vessel was launched. Pumping water was a strenuous job for two men, and with only one working pump, they would never get on top of the leaking. The best they could hope for was to keep it at bay until they reached Chile. As they headed further south, a ferocious wind picked up and was gaining strength by the hour. As the ship began to be tossed about, the less experienced pirates were hit by a sudden seasickness, with many taking to their bunks and being violently ill. The ship rode up the top of the waves that stretched out before them like a monstrous mountain range and then came crashing down into the trough. It was a testament to James Hoy's shipbuilding skills that the Frederick did not break into pieces. As the men lay sick in their beds, the four experienced men did everything they could to man the ship, but they were severely short-handed. With no able bodies to pump the water out of the hold, it had quickly risen to waist height. Once the storm had passed, they assessed the leak and agreed to have two men on the pump 24 hours a day. Each man did a two-hour shift. The sailors pushed the ship to breaking point, feeling an overwhelming sense of urgency to get to Chile, but also with a sense of fear that they were somehow being closely followed. Though this was highly unlikely given the huge head start they had, they didn't have enough crew to work all the sails, so they downsized them, making them easier to manage. Over the coming days, the pirates fell into a routine, each with their own jobs, some performing them in between bouts of seasickness. On the 25th of February, they finally spotted land, though not all on board believed it was land. Barker thought it was a bank of cloud, but as they drew nearer, their hopes were confirmed. They had made the epic journey of more than 6,000 nautical miles to the coast of South America in about 6 weeks with just a handful of experienced men. Most voyages had at least 7 times that many crew. What they had achieved was truly incredible. The men were absolutely exhausted, but euphoric. The Frederick was now just limping along, gaining water at a fast pace. Its timbers groaned as it cut through the water. She had served them well, but wouldn't make it for the last leg of the journey. Porter described her in his memoir, quote, "Proud we were of it," end quote. The pirates began preparing to take the longboat. There was much work to be done to it. It needed to be rigged with a sail and refitted to allow room for all 10 of them. They transferred what food they had left into the longboat, along with all the arms and ammunition. They weren't going to land just anywhere in Chile. They wanted to come ashore at the port of Valdivia. By the time the 10 men and their cat boarded the longboat, the water had reached the bulkhead and was rising fast. They were all sad to see her go. They had left all the hatches open so she would not break apart, but gracefully subside into the depths of the ocean. Crammed into the longboat, they made their way closer to land. The sea was angry, sending huge waves down upon them, drenching them and everything in the boat. They spent a very uncomfortable, wet night, and by morning they were absolutely freezing. They had made a direct beeline for land, but it took them a while to find the right little cove that would provide shelter for their boat. It wasn't until late afternoon that they disembarked. It had been about 6 weeks since they had last felt solid ground underneath their feet. They stumbled out of the sea and onto dry sand, and then explored the surrounding forest, trying to regain their land legs. They were disappointed not to find any signs of human civilization. They longed for fresh water and food. At some point, their lucky cat dashed into the forest, never to be seen again. For the next few days, they travelled up the coast looking for any signs of civilization. Eventually, they came across the Mapuche people, the indigenous people of Chile. The Mapuche people were very friendly. However, they did not offer them any food, but were able to tell them through hand gestures just how far away Valdivia was. It was only another 3 leagues, which is roughly 16 kilometres. The men jumped back into the boat and pushed off, excited for the last leg of their journey. Only a few hours later, they rounded the bend and found themselves in the large, well-sheltered, bustling port of Valdivia. It had taken them roughly 7 weeks, and they had reached what looked to be a paradise with its crystal blue calm water, green pine trees with a backdrop of a rugged mountain range tucked behind the town. There were also small islands dotted about. To their surprise, they were welcomed with open arms. Other boats sailed up to greet them and help them find the best spot to come ashore. A group of soldiers happily helped them carry their longboat onto the beach. The men felt a sense of joy, relief, and excitement as they embarked on their new life with their new identities. They settled into society as 10 gentlemen who had come from Liverpool on the Mary that had been shipwrecked on their way to Valparaiso. They gave themselves new names, and James Porter even changed nationalities, becoming James O'Connor, the Irishman. They told the Chileans a sorrowful story of the captain of their ship refusing to leave and going down with her. When the Chileans asked what their trades were, some said carpenters and others said they were sailors. So the group was split up, with the carpenters sent 10 miles upriver to the town centre, where there was a great need for their skills, and the 5 sailors went to Valparaiso. However, on their way up the river, one of the carpenters got drunk and made a slip up. When they arrived in town, they were immediately escorted to holding cells, where the Chileans began to interrogate them. Meanwhile, the sailors spent the evening having a great time partying on the beach until they woke up dazed and confused with soldiers pointing their guns at them. The men were taken to the barracks where they were locked into cells. During the interrogations, one of the pirates cracked. According to Porter, it was Cheshire who gave a full confession to the governor. Once the truth was out, they asked the governor for clemency. The governor was curious why they had chosen their country, and one of them replied, quote, "Because we knew that you were patriots and had long ago declared your independence," end quote. The governor agreed to support their bid for freedom by trying to convince the Chilean Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs in Santiago. He did this with the condition that they do not attempt to escape. He then freed them under parole. They were not to leave Valdivia and had to report regularly to an officer. The men were both surprised and relieved. The next few months were spent enjoying the fruits of Valdivian life. They all found employment, some working in the shipyards, while others worked on government vessels. It wasn't long before some of the men got married, despite the fact that they were already married with children. Their incredible story was published in the local paper, and the people of Valdivia viewed them as legends. The fact that they had crossed the ocean in a leaky boat to escape their captors earned them the respect and love of the local people. Somehow, a copy of the newspaper article was put into the hands of Governor Arthur of Van Diemen's Land. He had a very different view of the 10 convicts and wrote to England expressing the need to recapture the men. Letters were sent and negotiations began between the Chilean Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Don Joaquin Tocorno, and the British Vice Consul in Valparaiso, Colonel John Walpole. Tocorno didn't want to give the convicts up. He knew that his people had embraced the men and there would be a public outcry if they were sent back to England. Plus, the men had displayed model behaviour in the months that they had been with them. He knew that if they were sent back, they would probably be hanged for their crimes, and that didn't sit well with him and his people. So he bought time by demanding papers with all their information, noting that the piratical seizure wasn't surprising given the deplorable conditions that they had been subjected to in Van Diemen's Land. Walpole demanded they be imprisoned until their papers arrived from England, but this was denied. The 10 convicts realised that they were on borrowed time, so Barker started looking for a way out. He propositioned a captain who had had his brig impounded for bringing in illicit cargo. He made an agreement that if he could secure his ship, that the captain would give him and his mates passage to wherever they were sailing to next. They waited for a moonless night, and 9 of the convicts, Cheshire was not included in this plan, slipped out of the town and sailed away. They were in 2 groups. There were the 3 Johns, Dady, Fair and Jones in 1 little sailboat, and the 6 others were in a dinghy. The 3 Johns were easily able to get out to meet the ship, but the others were faced with a strong current and heavy onshore winds. They knew that they would never be able to get out to the ship and were forced to abandon the getaway. The 3 Johns left without them and were never seen again. It is thought that they sailed to Peru, and eventually 2 of them went to America. When Walpole learned of their escape, he was furious. Fearful of Walpole's obsession with capturing them, Barker began a new plan of escape. He and some of the other men started building their own whale boat under the pretense of making it for the governor. When it was complete, Barker, Leslie and Russen quietly rowed it out on a very calm night and managed to pass the heads where they had got into trouble the last time and pushed out into the ocean. Barker left his wife and newborn child, and Leslie and Russen also left their wives behind. The following morning, when it was discovered that the 3 convicts were missing, the last 4 remaining men, Porter, Cheshire, Shires and Lyon, were locked up in the cells. They no longer had the governor's protection, as he had been replaced by a new governor. Porter noted in his memoir, quote, "I then gave up hope of ever regaining my liberty," end quote. The men were chained together in pairs, as letters went back and forth between the Chileans and the British. Months later, a vessel was arranged to pick the 4 convicts up. Before it arrived, Porter made another attempt to escape by filing away at his leg irons and scaling the wall of the prison. He was soon caught and sent back. Right before Christmas in 1835, Leslie and Russen were also recaptured, but after bribing a guard, they managed to escape again. By late April 1836, the last of the 10 Frederick men were escorted in chains onto HMS Basilisk and said goodbye to the freedom they had enjoyed for the past 2 years. They spent months travelling to different places, including back to England, and then were put on a ship to Hobart. A very close eye was kept on all of them out of fear that they may piratically seize the ship. The story of their capture of the Frederick had travelled and had taken on a life of its own. They were looked on in awe and fear. According to Porter's memoir, Lyon and Cheshire accused him and Shires of planning a mutiny, and they were flogged mercilessly. When they arrived in Hobart, there was a new governor in place. There they awaited their trial. Porter was still claiming to be an innocent man by the name of James O'Connor, but many in Hobart town knew his real identity. The trial began and ended within a month of their return. They were being charged with 3 counts. The first was piracy. The second and third were charges concerning the betrayal of trust as sworn mariners. Several witnesses were called, which included Mr. Hoy, the shipwright, James Tate, the first mate, William Nichols, one of the convicts, and others. All four men claimed not to have taken active parts in the mutiny. They had only been following the other convicts out of fear. They repeatedly pointed out how they had not ill-treated their captives and had provided them with provisions. It was also raised as part of their defence that technically the Frederick had not been registered yet and could not therefore be seen as piratically seized. The jury took less than an hour and came back with a verdict of guilty, pointing out that they were of the opinion that the offence was not committed on the high seas, nor were they technically mariners. Justice Pedder noted, quote, "The offence itself is a robbery, not a piracy," end quote. Not knowing what to do with the men, their sentence was suspended indefinitely. They lingered in prison for 2 years. The men had gained the sympathy of the public. They had not harmed anyone in the process of taking the Frederick. It was agreed that they just tried to escape a terrible and inhumane place. The case was debated in the Executive Council, and it was agreed that they should not face the death penalty, but were to be transported for life to Norfolk Island. James Porter was in and out of trouble for the rest of his life. Lyon, too, was in and out of trouble, but eventually received a pardon. William Shires spent some time in Newcastle, then was awarded a ticket of leave and then a pardon for good conduct. William Cheshire committed a few minor offences, which earned him a trip back to Van Diemen's Land, but earned himself a pardon in 1850. The other Frederick men were never heard of again, though there were many rumours about where they ended up. Thank you for listening to the Convict Australia podcast. If you'd like to show your appreciation and get more involved, there are a number of ways you can. The first is by signing up to Convict Australia on Patreon, and you will get some perks like the Convict Australia newsletter. Secondly, leave a review and tell your friends and family. This really does make a huge difference. And lastly, join the Facebook and Instagram group Convict Australia. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes. Thank you again. Till next time.